balconies.
Okay. Up next, we have Tiffany St. Patrick Wells, who has the distinction of having the longest last name of anyone here. she's going to give a topic called Two Types of... This is the first one, right? The first presentation is called Warrants, Wiretaps, and Probable Cause. And she's going to give another presentation on Sunday. She'd like you all to know that she's not a lawyer. I'm sure she'll talk about this, but it should still be informative and interesting. So I'll give a big round of applause for Tiffany.
Good afternoon. I want to make it clear right from the start that I'm not a lawyer, and the reason I have to talk about that is because it's illegal for me to give legal advice or talk about legal consequences to actions. So when we do the question and answer session, if I'm hesitating, chances are I'm trying to figure out how I can answer your question without giving legal advice. The things that I can talk about are more along the lines of the kind of advice you'd get from your mom. Stuff like be careful, plan ahead, know yourself, know what you're up against, those kinds of things. So I'd like for everyone to take the presentation sort of in that light rather than thinking, okay, now I know how I cannot get arrested, or now I know exactly what I need to do to preserve evidence for the FBI, because that's not what I can talk about. So the topic today of my speech is going to be basically the Fourth Amendment. And first I'll cover the Fourth Amendment for a while, and then I'll take a few questions, and then I'd like to talk about the exclusionary rule and evidence just briefly. And then I'll take some more questions if I have time. I was wondering if there's an audience volunteer who's ever been subject to search or seizure by the police who'd be willing to and wants to come up here and tell everyone about it. Okay, I kind of thought that might happen. In any case, just the basic framework here is, for those of you who slept through your government class in high school, we have a Constitution, and the first 10 amendments are known as the Bill of Rights, and they afford some basic protections to people during their interactions with the government. And the Fourth Amendment is the one that covers searches and seizures. The Fourth Amendment protects your right. It guarantees the right of you to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. And there are a couple clauses to the Fourth Amendment. The one I'm going to talk about first is the search and seizure clause, and then later I'll talk about the warrants clause. So the search and seizure clause tells you basically who has the right, and that's a person, and it's personal to you to be secure in your person, house, papers, and effects from unreasonable searches and seizures. So as far as the people go, it's a personal right. So I can't assert my Fourth Amendment right to have him not be searched. It doesn't work that way. And the case that we looked at last semester when I took the criminal procedure class was there was a car, and one person gave consent to the police for the car to be searched. There was a purse in the car, and the person whose car it was later tried to say, you can't search that purse, but the purse belonged to someone else. So you can't, once he gave consent for the car to be searched, he also can't assert his right to not have somebody else's purse searched. So it's personal to you, and you can't assert somebody else's Fourth Amendment right. The Fourth Amendment, the text of it lists certain places, and the old way that they used to look at it was that it mattered a lot more where you were. But there's a new test for searches, which I'll talk about later, but you do have some higher protection for searches of your body, your person, your clothing, your house, and other places have less protection. The biggest one is the car. And the reason for that I'll talk about a little later, but it basically boils down to an exigent circumstances exception to the warrants clause, which has to do with a car is movable, so they think that you can destroy evidence by getting rid of the car, so there's like a lowered expectation of privacy there, and because it's on the road. So there are a lot of reasons why. And one of the worst things, I think, in my opinion, in Fourth Amendment doctrine is the fact that a mobile home, if you live in a mobile home, that's considered a car. And so it's not your house. You don't have the same protections as a person who lives in a house. I think that's terribly wrong. The way you can make your mobile home be protected as if it were a house were to make it immovable, so build a porch all the way around the outside of it so it can't be moved at all. Then your mobile home is considered a home. I think that's kind of unfair to people who live in mobile homes, but that's just my opinion. So the events that are covered by the search and seizure clause are searches and seizures. And the definition of a seizure is, for property, is substantial interference with a possessory interest. So that goes back to the whose purse was it. It has to be your purse, and it has to be a substantial interference. But that can be... it's kind of intuitive. If they take your stuff, then it's a seizure of your stuff. As far as a person goes, it's not a seizure of the person if the police just come up and talk to you. And the standard for that is, would a reasonable person believe that they're free to leave? So if they cuff you, that's a seizure. I mean, you've been seized. That's pretty clear. But there are some gray areas where they come up and talk to you. There's a point at which you're probably in custody, and it has to do with what would a reasonable person think. So that's basically how that doctrine works. But as far as figuring out what reasonable people believe, that's up to the courts, and they tend to be very deferential to law enforcement. So you can always try asking the police, am I free to leave? And if they say yes, you can try walking away. I don't know what would happen if you did that, but that's just a thought I had about that. As far as the event, the searches, the old test relied a lot more heavily on locations. So the old test was a trespassory invasion. The example we talked about in class was a wiretap. It was a long time ago, and so they did the wiretap by physically attaching equipment to the line outside this guy's house, and then they listened to the conversations. And that was not a trespassory invasion of his house because it was outside his house. So they said that did not require a warrant. That wasn't even a search. They were free to just listen to this person's conversations. That's the old test. The new test is more of a two-prong test. And the two prongs of the test have... The two prongs are one's subjective and one's objective. The subjective prong of the test is your manifest actual expectation of privacy. And what subjective means is it's subjective to the person, to the defendant or the suspect. So it has to do with what you manifest to the outside world. Did you try to keep this thing private? If you are talking about, if you're on a... in the middle of the street shouting about crimes that you've committed, you're not exhibiting an actual expectation of privacy. You're exhibiting it to the world. They're not going to protect that. Then the other prong of the test is subjective, and it's determined by the courts, and it's based on what society is willing to protect. And once again, the courts are a little bit deferential to law enforcement here. Sometimes if the search, it can be kicked out at the first prong. It's not illegal because you didn't exhibit an actual expectation of privacy. But sometimes, in rare cases, it could not pass the first prong but still be protected. An example that my teacher gave of this is if you're from another country and in that country, the government just sort of searches everybody and they don't have to have warrants and they do whatever they want. Society here is still willing to protect you against an unreasonable search and seizure, even if you don't have a subjective belief that you're free from that. So, moving off that. Some things are just presumed reasonable, just right off the bat. And the big important one for everyone is consent. If you say, go ahead and search my car, they are going to search your car. And I've noticed from watching the television show Cops that usually what they do is they phrase it, do you mind if I search your car? So that if you say no, they're going to search your car. Or if you don't say anything, they might presume that you are consenting. So the best thing you can do there is just don't give consent. Say, yes, I mind, or maybe ask, I don't know. I can't tell you what to do, actually. You should talk to a lawyer about that. Okay, and then some things are presumed reasonable because you have you've not exhibited the expectation of privacy. So when you put garbage out at the curb, that's considered abandoned, and they can go through that to their heart's content. You're not protected there. Stuff in plain view, and that includes aerial. They have marijuana cultivation cases where they fly over and see the plants from the air, and that is considered plain view. You didn't protect your privacy. The case that's the farthest on the edge of that we read last semester was this guy had a greenhouse, and he had put tiles all over the greenhouse roof to protect it from aerial view, and he had a fence, and it was pretty well protected, except one of the tiles had fallen down. So they were able to see with binoculars and a telephoto camera through this tile in there, and they saw these marijuana plants, and they said that he was not exhibiting a reasonable expectation of privacy because he didn't keep up the maintenance on his greenhouse to keep the tile on the roof. So it's pretty deferential to law enforcement there. You have to really protect your privacy. One thing that's not clear is satellite surveillance. And part of that, the reason that it's not clear is it's considered, there's an argument being made by prosecutors that because people can go on and access satellite views through NASA, that anybody can have access to that, and so you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. But the defense attorneys are arguing that we don't have access to control where the camera's pointed or what they take pictures of or zooming in or out, so they're sort of presuming that that's not something that law enforcement should be able to use. And there's also the question of, do you have an expectation of privacy there? Is society willing to protect that? So that's just sort of, that's up to the Supreme Court, and we're not sure what they're going to do with that. Okay, more stuff that's presumed reasonable. If you have probable cause by a law enforcement official who goes out and gets a warrant, that's presumed reasonable. Everything's okay under the Fourth Amendment. Other things that are the probable cause test is based on the totality of the circumstances. So the courts are going to look at the context of the search, the context of the seizure, what you did, what the police did, and once again, they're deferential to the police. There's a higher probable cause standard for use of deadly force. The case that we looked at for that was there was a suspected burglary, and it might have been a robbery. I don't remember the exact crime, but it was a young man who was about 15 years old, was jumping over the fence. The police shot him in the back and killed him. And they said that that was an unreasonable use of deadly search because the level of suspicion that they had, all they saw was this guy in the backyard and they shot him, was not enough to justify the use of deadly force. And in that case, they should have let the suspect get away. And there's also a higher level of suspicion needed for surgical invasion of your body. And there are cases where people swallow evidence, basically, and they want to perform surgery to get it out of them. And the courts have said, no, you have to have a little bit more suspicion for that. There's a lower level of suspicion called articulable reasonable suspicion, which is basically if they can articulate or state any reason why they're suspicious, they're going to get to do certain things. It generally applies in the case of traffic stops. Let's say if they can say you were acting suspicious, they're going to be able to do a special kind of stop called a Terry stop where they frisk you. Moving on to the warrants clause. The warrants clause says that no warrants shall issue without probable cause, and they have to be particular in that they state the person to be seized and the person to be searched and the thing to be searched or seized. So basically realize there are two different kinds of search warrants. One's an arrest warrant to arrest a person or seize a thing, and one is a search warrant, but usually they get them both together, so you don't usually see one without the other. You might see a search warrant without a seizure warrant, but so in order to get the warrant, they have to have probable cause, unless there's an exception. And how they get that is they have gathered enough evidence that they can go to a magistrate and say, we have a suspicion that there's a crime going on. They're going to sign off on it. They're free and clear. They can search your house. They can seize your computers. They can do whatever they want that's within the scope of the warrant. As far as wiretaps go, they're now considered a search. They didn't used to be. And there are some code sections. These code sections are also, you can find them easily on the internet. They're on some of the FBI pages. I have a resource sheet I'll be handing out tomorrow that has those pages on them. But basically, carnivore and sniffers and those kind of things, they are wiretaps. I mean, they should be getting a warrant if they're going to use carnivore, but they can still use the evidence, even if they violate the Fourth Amendment for other purposes, which I'll talk about later in the exclusionary rule. So theoretically, they should be getting a warrant before they use carnivore, but for some reason, I don't know if you heard Richard Forno's, is that his first name? Mr. Forno's keynote's address yesterday, but people don't think carnivore is even a bad idea. The general public consensus is go ahead and listen to everybody's conversations. We don't care. And because of that, and because of this two-pronged test for the reasonableness, if society's not willing to protect your interest and your privacy in your email, then it's just not going to be protected. And that's why the two-pronged test matters. I mean, if people are of the opinion that it doesn't matter, the Supreme Court's not going to protect your rights in all likelihood. Monitoring warnings is something that if you are in charge of security, you might want to have little warnings that say that when you go on the system that you're consenting to being monitoring, because consent is automatically reasonable. So I'm doing a judicial externship, which means I'm working at a court. And every time I turn on an internet browser, I get a little warning that says, your activities are being monitored. If you don't consent to being monitored, please don't use the system. And they've showed me the reports. They keep track of every single place every single court employee goes every single day. So they are monitoring, and they can do it. And the reason it's not illegal for them to do it is because they have this little disclaimer warning that's up there. And otherwise, it would probably be an illegal wiretap. As far as warrant exceptions, if they have some kind of suspicion, and there are reasons why they might not have to get a warrant, they're called exigent circumstances. And the first one is hot pursuit. This is just basically you're actually chasing someone. You can see them the whole time. They don't need a warrant to search and seize that person. To prevent escape is another one. If they have the house surrounded, they can usually search the house. But there's another doctrine called seize and freeze, which is they just make the scene safe. Then they call. They can call any time of day or night, get a judge to give them a warrant like that. It's really easy for law enforcement to get warrants. Another exigent circumstance is public safety, and that includes the police. So if they think someone has a bomb, they don't need a warrant. They can go in and try to neutralize the situation. And imminent destruction of evidence, and this is where a lot of stuff's going to come in with computers. If they think that you've got something that they want before you can delete it, they're just going to come in without a warrant. But warrants are so easy to get. I'm of the opinion that they shouldn't, these exigent circumstances sort of go too far. They kind of negate the Fourth Amendment in some cases because it's so easy to get a warrant. If they have time to drive to your house, they can be on the phone with the judge while they're on the way there. I don't see why they don't just get warrants more often. There are more warrant exceptions. I kind of briefly referred to the Terry stop. That's if they have a suspicion, they can do a pat-down search. Anything that's obvious as contraband, like a gun or a hypodermic syringe. I don't know how this would apply in the context of computer-related stuff, but generally it's anything that's immediately apparent as contraband. They can take that. There's consent also negates the need for a roommate. If they have a suspicion that something's going on, they show up at your house and your roommate says, go ahead and search the house, they can search your room. And the only way to stop that is to have a lock on the door of your room. So if you have roommates, you might want to think about putting a lock on the door of your room. That's what my teacher said. And that's not legal advice. Then for non-law enforcement searches and seizures, there's an ad hoc balancing test. And this applies in the context of work or schools or places where it's not the government doing it, although one could argue that at the school it is the government, but they don't buy that argument. They've been able to search student purses and backpacks. They've been able to do student drug testing for athletes. They can do pre-employment drug testing. They can do a lot of things like that. And that, of course, covers them monitoring anything you do at work, including your email, anything that you have on their equipment that's owned by your employer. Does anybody have any questions before I go on to the exclusionary doctrine? Okay. Y'all look sleepy. All right. The exclusionary rule is the consequence for law enforcement of the Fourth Amendment violation. Let's say they don't have enough suspicion, the courts find that they needed a warrant and they didn't have one, or the warrant's defective for some reason. There's a doctrine called the fruit of the poison tree doctrine. And what it says is that you can't use the evidence that's illegally obtained to prove guilt against that defendant. And remember, this is a personal right. So if they do an illegal wiretap on you there, they can use whatever they find out on your from that illegal wiretap against that guy over there. So if you're talking to him or somebody else, they can use that information to prove his guilt in court. So the protections afforded by the Fourth Amendment are pretty personal to you. And that's often what they do is they'll put a wiretap without a warrant, they'll get enough information that they're going to go after someone else. And because the other person doesn't have a right to assert that person's Fourth Amendment rights, there's nothing you can do at that point. It can also be used if it's illegally obtained information for impeachment. So that means if they put a wiretap on his phone, and then he takes the stand in his own defense to say, well, I didn't do these things I'm accused of, they can then use the illegally obtained information that they got through an illegal wiretap against him for impeachment purposes. And then the jury will be told it's not to prove the truth of the matter asserted, blah, 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 but juries don't tend to make those kinds of distinctions. They can be given those warnings, but what's going to probably happen is they're going to decide that the person's guilty based on the illegally obtained information. And also, it doesn't apply in grand jury testimony, civil trials, and probation revocation hearings. So let's say, I hope you don't mind if I kind of pick on you here. Let's say he's on probation for a prior violation. Let's say he was already on probation, so he commits another offense. They're going to have a probation revocation hearing. They can use illegally obtain information, to say you violated probation, send him to jail for that. And another reason for the discrepancy in the OJ, he had the criminal trial and then he had the civil trial. Part of that is because they can use evidence that the police illegally obtained in the civil trial. There are exceptions to the exclusionary rule. So if you make it over all these hurdles, they've totally violated your rights. There are some exceptions even to the exclusionary rule. One is the independent source rule. If they could have found that information from an independent source and they can prove it, they can still use it. But this one is one where this one's hard for law enforcement to get away with, because a really good example is the Oliver North proceedings. I don't know that much about it, but my teacher was saying that what happened was the Congress was so excited about getting his testimony so they would look good in front of the American people that they had him testify in congressional hearings. And then in the meantime, they had other people investigating Oliver North for criminal proceedings. And they tried to isolate themselves so that they wouldn't find out what he said before the Congress, but they couldn't, because they would have had to basically lock themselves in a room and not contact the outside world, because so many people watched the congressional testimony. The Supreme Court said, well, their wife could have told them what they saw during the congressional hearing. So basically, the exclusionary rule exception of the independent source rule is a lot stronger than some of the other ones. It does work if they really do isolate themselves. The place that it's really used is most often is there was a murder case where they got the guy to confess illegally, but they had search parties out and they were really near where the body was. And the Supreme Court said that they would have found the body anyway within a few hours, and that him saying where the body was there was an independent source that they would surely have found the body because of the way the search party was going. They were heading straight towards it. So that's how it works. Inevitable discovery is pretty close to the independent source rule. The independent source rule also applies to third parties. So anyway, it's the same thing with they can use evidence that they get from someone else against you. The attenuation doctrine is basically if the information is so far away from the illegal activity, then they can still use it. And the example that my teacher gave of this is they arrest somebody, they do illegal custodial interrogation, they let him go, and then he comes back 3 days later and confesses again. They said that the second confession was okay because he was free to change his mind about statements he made to the police in the meantime. And then there's good faith reliance. So this is where they have changes in laws. If they rely in good faith on an existing law, or if they have if the warrant is defective, but they rely on it in good faith, then the fruit of the poison tree doctrine doesn't apply unless the person who swore out the affidavit deliberately lied to the judge, or the warrant is so defective on its face that you could look at it and say, this is ridiculous. Like, nobody would believe this is a valid warrant. Like, let's say they say that we think that this guy is doing something wrong, so we're going to go search this guy's house. There's no logical connection. If they don't state in the affidavit that, well, he's been living at this guy's house for the past 3 months and that's where all the phone calls are originating from, then maybe they can search his house. But if all they say is, we think this guy, you know, broke into Bank of America and they're going to search this guy's house, that doesn't float. It has to be that bad. And evidence obtained has to be authenticated before it can be used in court. And basically that's just somebody saying that, yes, this is, like, if they're going to use logs against you, they have to have someone say, yes, these are the logs. You can't just bring in the printout and get it admitted into evidence. but there's a difference between evidence used against the person themselves and evidence used against a third party. So once again, it goes back to the whole thing of the Fourth Amendment rights are a personal right. Chain of custody is important on authentication, so the evidence could theoretically be tampered with. That's why law enforcement wants you to call them immediately and let them have their way with your equipment so they can image the whole system and get the logs and copy them and all that, because it could be argued in court that somebody tampered with the logs. But the problem with that is there's a presumption that the victim of a crime is not going to tamper with the logs to make it look like someone else did it. So most juries aren't going to believe that the log. If your only defense was company X tampered with the logs and made it look like I didn't and I really didn't, I don't. That's going to be a jury question, and they're probably not going to believe that. So the logs are important because eyewitness testimony isn't considered as reliable as physical evidence by most juries. So, all right, tomorrow I'm giving another talk, and I'll be talking more about preserving evidence for law enforcement, sort of what security experts should do, and a couple Fifth Amendment tips on what to do during custodial interrogations, all that kind of stuff, how to talk to law enforcement if you're a suspect. So with that, I would like to open it up for questions, if anybody has any questions. Yeah.
I have a thing on search and seizure. Every once in a while at a party or something, you get the cops that come. And if you even open your door just to talk to them, they can just come in after that. Because that's about my friend's own business. You can't even open the door for them. So, how does that work for you?
Don't construe this as being legal advice, but my teacher was asked the same question, and she said that when you open the door only wide enough to admit your body, slip outside and close the door behind you. Because she said that the basic idea is an open door is an invitation to enter, but if you only open the door enough to slip your body out and you close it behind you, you've sealed the house off behind you, and they don't have that presumption that they can just walk in. That's what she said to that one. Oh, yeah, you get candy. Any more questions?
Is the independent source rule similar to that of anonymous tips in drug-related cases? Where they won't disclose who they are. They don't make the sources reveal themselves to the grand jury. But, well, by God, you can't question them.
Tips and anonymous tips is a whole other area, and the independent source rule also does relate to it. The thing with tips is, tips are part of the probable cause doctrine. It can be part of probable cause if the police get a tip. And the most reliable tips are known informants with a track record. And these are people that basically the police have worked with before, and they know that they're a good informant, and they don't have to reveal their identity. And it seems like it would violate the Confrontation Clause, because you have a right to confront the witnesses against you. But the problem is that if they don't actually testify, then you don't get to confront them. So it's the anonymous tips are... It's not really part of the independent source rule, because the independent source rule is for... That's assuming that they're going to bring the person in and testify in court, and then you'd have access to their identity because you have a right to confront the witnesses against you. It's just sort of a technicality that for probable cause purposes, the anonymous tip is not considered a witness. It's just considered part of the circumstances or the context under which the police develop a suspicion, which leads them to get a warrant from the magistrate. So, am I making sense here?
It does, but some of my experience and some of what I've found is that the testimony of the tipsters is used to convict. is used to seal the case, and they can't be questioned. And most of the time, it's the word of the police, or even worse, the district attorney, that these people are good people. All they are is narcs.
You're talking about a grand jury, right? Yeah, because that's one of the exceptions to the Fourth Amendment is you can use this stuff in a grand jury or a civil trial, even if it's illegally obtained or, you know, doesn't meet the Fourth Amendment criteria. And so they can bring in these people who, right, it's just law enforcement's word. It's very deferential to law enforcement. If they say this person's reliable, the judge is going to believe them, basically. And in my experience, most law enforcement, they're honest, they're good, they're hardworking, they don't violate people's rights, but that's not 100% of people out there. I mean, I've been observing, I'm working in the courthouse, and I saw a trial where the police just, I don't know if they were out and out lying or they just forgot what happened, but the guy swore up and down on the stand that all these things happened a certain way and liquor bottles were inside the storage shed and there was a puddle of urine here and blah, 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 and on and on. And they put the owner of the storage shed on. And he contradicted everything the police said. And it kind of makes one wonder about the anonymous tips and the probable cause, because what's to say they're not going to say, oh, yeah, he said he could... You know, he said I could search his car. I mean, that's consent negates your rights. If you say, I'm willing to talk to you, they can talk to you. If you say, search my car, so who's to say that the police aren't just saying, we got an anonymous tip, but we don't have to tell you who it's from. It's a reliable source. It's kind of meaningless if the police aren't honest. So you just have to rely on... You just have to hope that the police officer or the FBI agent that you're dealing with is honest and trustworthy and truthful. And that's just how we have our society set up. They can lie and they can get away with it, and there's really nothing to stop them on anonymous tips and on consent. So, how about you first? In some cases, it would be, and there, if they say we have this person who always calls in these tips to us, and we know who they are, and in the past, it's led to an arrest and a conviction, that's automatically reliable. That's automatically enough.
Now, would they have to bring proof of that to the judge, or could it just be their word?
They're going to bring it to the judge, but the judges are going to believe them. That's just how it works. I mean. That's what a warrant's for. Anything they say, I wonder how much I can say. I just got an assignment. I'm looking at a warrant to see if, you know, and there are some things that aren't 100% accurate. But the standard is so low, it has to be that no reasonable judge in their right mind could think that there was enough evidence to go search that person's house. And that is such, I mean, that it doesn't take much for them to be able to get a search warrant and have it be valid. Does that answer your question?
Kind of. So technically, I guess what I'm wondering is, a cop could just totally BS, say to the judge that they heard from someone, which they actually didn't, and they won't have to prove it, they won't have to bring the person to the judge, and they won't have to prove it in court. They could just...
The way my teacher explained this is the Supreme Court has basically said that there's a interest in the police being able to investigate based on tips from basically anonymous parties and protecting their identity. And so we're just gonna let that happen. It's hard for me to answer that question because I might not agree with it because I think it's kind of weakening the Fourth Amendment, which is just my personal opinion. I think that, but I don't know what else can you do? I mean, you can't really, if the police decide to lie, there's not that much you can do about it. And you just have to hope, and most of them are honest, and you just have to hope that that if you're dealing with the police, that the person you're dealing with is not lying. And it seems very unfair, especially given the confrontation clause in the Constitution, but that says you have the right to confront the witnesses against you, that they're allowed to use these anonymous tips to get a grand jury indictment, at least, without you even knowing who that person is. And they can use that information to get third parties to say things about you. And, yeah. Okay. Candy, for you. Yes, what's your question?
What can limit the power or extent of probable cause? Because it seems to me that they can use probable cause to justify anything.
The only real limit on it is the exclusionary rule, the fruit of the poison tree doctrine, which says that they can't use the evidence if they obtain it illegally. And there were other schemes that were tried, but nothing works because... like, what they could do is they could say... Yeah, I can't really think of anything else besides the exclusionary rule that would really help limit the police to reasonable searches, and so...
Because it seems to me that, like, a lot of things could be considered by them as probable cause, like a wide range of things, and it's pretty much limitless. There's no thing to, like, limit their power to using probable cause. It seems like a very wide range of things could be probable cause. They could make it up to be anything they want.
That is true to an extent. They can just sort of say, well, I had a suspicion based on my years of police experience and this anonymous tip that this guy was doing something illegal, and that's going to float. And that's, I don't know if there's any, I mean, I don't really have any answer to what can be done about that. That's just the way it is. And part of it goes back to society. Society's probably, because by the time this all comes out, there probably was a crime committed, and society just has an interest. People have decided that we would rather go ahead and weaken the Fourth Amendment than put any more limits on police activity. So I don't know if I'm answering your question. Yeah, it is kind of limit. It is pretty deferential to police judgment. If they can say that this is a reliable informant, that the judge is going to believe him, the warrant's going to issue, the evidence is going to come in.
So you could use probable cause for just about anything. I mean, they can make it up to be whatever they need it to be.
Well, theoretically, the judge won't issue the warrant if it doesn't seem reasonable. So they have to come in and they have to swear under penalty of perjury on the affidavit to the judge saying, well, this person... An example I heard of is somebody bought something with money that smelled like marijuana. Okay? Now, just on its face, that sounds unreasonable to me, because how do they know where the money came from? And, you know, it's pretty bad, right? But the other part of that story is, and that's what the defense attorney was arguing, but the other part of that story is the dog also, they had a dog come out and the dog alerted on the car and said that there were drugs in the car. Now when you hear that part of the story, okay, now it's reasonable that the judge said, okay, now you have a dog that says there's drugs in the car. But just, if it was just the money, I think that most judges would say, you know, money, you don't know where it's been, you don't know how that smell got on there. That's ridiculous to have a dog alert on a dollar bill and say that this person is in possession of drugs. So it's pretty lenient, but there are some limits on it.
Well, in that case, they used the probable cause of the gateway. They would have never found the other evidence if they didn't have the probable cause of the gateway.
It starts as a suspicion, but there's this whole it's part of the plain view doctrine. Dogs can sniff anything, anywhere, pretty much. I mean, and so if that's not entirely true, but they can't bring a dog in your house. But like in customs, they have drug sniffing dogs there. They run it all over all the packages. They can. It depends on where you are and what you're doing, but. Hey, give him Kenny. You had a question back there? My teacher said that that does violate his Fourth Amendment rights, but you cannot assert his Fourth Amendment rights. So if they put a wiretap on him and use the evidence against you, then there's no remedy. Yeah, people's rights have been violated, but the only remedy is the exclusionary rule, and it doesn't apply if it's used against a third party. And also, usually what they're going to use that for is not against you in court. They're not going to bring in the illegal wiretap into court. What they're going to do is they're going to go to him, and they're going to say, we heard you talking to him. You're an accessory to a felony. We're going to arrest you unless you turn him in, blah, 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 blah. And they're going to get him to make statements against you is what. Couldn't he do what? There used to be a theory that you could maintain a private cause of action in a civil trial against the police. This was before the exclusionary rule. And what they said was you just sue the police for violating your civil rights. And eventually the Supreme Court said that is ridiculous. No jury is going to convict that police officer for violating a criminal's rights. And so they said, from now on, what we're going to do is have the exclusionary rule where you can't use the evidence. And it's intended to punish the police for being wrong. So I hope that gives you some answer. Whoop. All right. Weak arm. Somebody pass that back to him. you over there. But if they're not, well, your best bet is always call a lawyer and they're going to help you with this. But if they're not going to, they might interrogate him and tell him they're going to go after him, but they probably aren't. If they think that this guy committed the crime, they're going to tell him we're going to arrest you to get him to make statements against the third person. So, but your best bet is, you know, and I'm talking about this more tomorrow, keep your mouth shut and ask for a lawyer. Yeah. Really, but just.
In his situation, assuming he gets a lawyer, he should be able to have some sort of remedy of asserting his Fourth Amendment rights that you, in trying to get this guy violated my Fourth Amendment, I can't assert his rights, but can he say, well, I just found out you busted my rights, I want to contest that?
No. But, I mean, what remedy do you propose?
Just basically, he's trying to fight it, but the information gave that it's being used against him.
The Supreme Court said no to that. There was a case, it was a car, you know, it was the purse case. The car was stopped, the guy gave consent to a search, it was this woman's purse, and nobody said, it's my purse, and then it was too late. See, the problem is, okay, if you're going to be subject to a search and you know it, if you say, it's my purse or my backpack, all they really have to do is call a judge and get a warrant. They're going to search it. If you say, it's not mine, then they can search it because it's nobody's personal effect and there's no Fourth Amendment protection for something that nobody's claiming as their own. So it's kind of a bind there. Between saying it's yours and saying it's not yours and asserting your own rights, they're not going to let you go back later and say, oh yeah, well, it was my purse. If you didn't claim that it was your purse when they first said, whose purse is this? they're going to say, well, you said it wasn't yours, so that we didn't violate your rights because you claimed it wasn't yours at the time. You want stuff thrown at you. Yeah, you back there?
Going back to logs being used against you in court, let's say that the victim did not make this invalid, basically, the best. What about something like the OJ defense, where you might hold a third party all of these logs? It's quite possible because somebody would have to get in there. And they're pointing the finger at me with using logs, invalid logs. And you can legally properly prove it's very easy.
The thing about the authentication of the logs, there's a couple different issues with authentication. One is just getting it admitted by the judge, because if stuff is totally unreliable, it's not going to be admitted because it's not going to be considered to meet the evidentiary burden. But what you're really talking about falls more in the realm of believing the evidence, and that's the province of the jury. And so what's probably going to happen is the judge is going to let the logs in, and then your attorney is going to have to convince the jury that the logs were tampered with. But the problem with juries and reasonable doubt is, you know, sometimes they believe it and sometimes they don't. It's kind of a lottery there. I mean, if you ever watch a trial from start to finish, you'll see juries are kind of unpredictable and you don't know what they're going to believe. And also, they tend to believe law enforcement a lot more than they believe defendants. It's just the nature of it, especially for things they don't understand. Like if you have a drunk driving case, people are that's a little bit more in most people's realm of everyday life and experience. If you have some cracking case, most people don't have experience with that, and they're not going to understand or believe you when you say, I didn't do these things and here's why. They're going to be more inclined to believe the government experts. That's just my opinion. That's what I think, how that would fall out. So, but it's a defense. It's a strategy. You have another question?
Just real quickly, as far as probable cause goes, you kind of wondered what you could do about it. Well, as long as there are people like Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court, and the president said that Antonin Scalia is his favorite justice, he's about his ass back for these guns. But the case about it, they were testing the mothers, they were taking samples of their...
The drug urine. Testing.
Yeah, unbeknownst to them. So they were actually seizing bodily fluids and personal effects to an intimate degree. And then, I mean, he said that the government had an open... I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, the government had a case.
Well, there... On the drug... this was a case about... You're talking about the drug testing of the mothers the pregnant mothers. I thought I saw a little blurb that was found to be unconstitutional.
Scalia
Thomas, I like to call him, because everything that Scalia does, Thomas does it too. So Scalia Thomas was in the was dissenting on that, thought it was perfectly fine for the hospital to take blood samples of the mother and then prosecute them in criminal court. And some people are very less protective of your rights than others on the Supreme Court. And Scalia is one of those who is going to... It's surprising to see him ever care about your First Amendment rights or your Second Amendment rights or your... I mean, you name it, third or fourth. And that's why I personally don't understand why all the NRA people threw their support in behind Bush, because he likes Scalia so much and Scalia doesn't care about rights. But that's just me. I don't know. Do you have another question?
Going back to the wiretapping thing. Say the third party asserted the right, saying that you had no right to tap my phone in the first place. if somehow that went over, and would that prevent the original suspect, that evidence being used against him, like, since it was found unconstitutional to begin with?
Okay, let me see if I understand your hypothetical. So you've got person A, and they have a wiretap, or they're using carnivore against them or something like that, and then they get evidence, and what do they do with that evidence now?
To use against someone else.
To use against, a third party?
Yeah.
They're probably not going to use the illegal wiretap. They can use it against a third party, but that would probably happen if you're exchanging email with somebody and that person talks about a crime they did to you, and they can... I could be wrong about this, and you really have to ask a lawyer, but the way I understood it last semester in criminal procedure is, yeah, they can use the evidence that they get from wiretapping you against a third party.
Even if the person that they wiretap asserted their own rights?
Because they can't, because you can only assert your own...
Yeah, I'm saying that if the person found out that they were being wiretapped and they asserted their rights, would they be able to use that evidence against the other person?
Well, you can't assert somebody else's rights, so you can't...
He's asserting his own rights.
It's like the
but
guy
you can't...
who's getting his wiretap asserts his rights before that evidence goes to court.
You can't...
That evidence that was going to court, would that still be valid?
There's no right to assert before you go to court. The way the only remedy really is the exclusionary rule. And the exclusionary rule says you can't use the evidence against that person. So there's no way for you to stand up and, I mean, you could sue, you could bring a civil suit, I suppose, and
so even if
it's not going to help that other person.
So even if they did assert their own rights, the police would, in effect, still be accomplishing their goal by being able to use the evidence against the other person.
Yeah, and basically you have the Supreme Court to thank for that. People like Scalia said, we don't care about that. I mean, that's what the case basically said, is you can use illegally obtained evidence against third parties, unless I got this totally wrong, which I could have, so ask a lawyer, because I'm not one. Okay. You had a question there in the green shirt?
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? I think I'm done. And I'm happy to take more questions. I'm also talking more tomorrow about interrogations and stuff, and I'm happy to go over that tomorrow, and I'm happy to take more questions outside. So thank you for your time.